Brother David and my beloved brothers and sisters, our young people. We have a very lengthy chapter in front of us this morning, and it is full of great interest and information. We have, of course, in reading chapter 4, passed over two other chapters, of which we won't be making more than a brief comment. But here is a very fascinating thought. I believe that Nebuchadnezzar has an equal chance to be in the kingdom of God. That may at first shock many, but I believe that God endeavoured to work with Nebuchadnezzar in a way that is not seen with any other heathen monarch. You take, for example, the influence of chapter 1 upon the thinking of Nebuchadnezzar. He had a grand scheme, as it were, to take over the kingdom of Judah and manipulate the people of God to his own desires. It was a consummate failure because of the determination of one young man who determined in his heart that he would not be swayed by the influences of the king of Babylon. So he affected four other young men who were moved by his strong and solid example. And so out of that came four boys who the king recognized were distinctive in the abilities that they had. As for these four children, chapter 1, verse 17, God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. Now at the end of the days the king had said he should bring them in, then the prince of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king communed with them, and among them all was found none like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore stood they before the king. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding, can you see those four young bright minds? That the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers that were in all his realm. What an astonishing thing that must have been. So his intention has been completely refuted. They are 10 times wiser than the best wise men that he could find in his realm. What about chapter 2? We know it so well, we will not hesitate. But what was the outcome upon Nebuchadnezzar of chapter 2? And why was it that God elected to give to this heathen king such a privilege as to record to him the history of the nations? I mean, you might have expected that that should be given to perhaps the most noble of all those in the Old Testament. But to our intrigued interest, it is given to none less than Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, the head of the kingdom of men. What an amazing thing that is when we begin to think about that. But it's through his prophet that the message is revealed. Well, the effect upon Nebuchadnezzar was absolutely remarkable. Look at verse 47. The king answered unto Daniel and said, of a truth it is that your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of secrets, seeing thou couldest reveal this secret. You know, that is a greater statement than perhaps we might normally appreciate. There were two principal gods, as I mentioned last night, over the Babylonians. The first being Bel-Merodach, who was King of kings, Lord of lords, the supreme God, God of gods. That title now has been given to the God of Daniel, which for Nebuchadnezzar to ascribe to the God of Daniel was a most remarkable thing, because as I said last night, he'd gone to great lengths to beautify the temple of Marduk or Merida with all the gold that he could bring from all of his victories worldwide. Now he has ascribed to the God of Daniel the very prime title of his personal deity, who was Bel-Merodach. And revealer of secrets? Well, that was the special prerogative of Nebo, who was the second of the great gods of the Babylonians. So both Merodach and Nebo had their chief qualities now ascribed, would you believe it, to the God of this Jewish young exile boy. What an amazing statement is verse 47. Is not God working with Nebuchadnezzar? doesn't Paul say in the 1st of Timothy chapter 2, in the very context when he's saying that we should pray for all men, does he not there say that God would have all men to be saved? What an interesting point. You know, if you read carefully that 1st of Timothy chapter 2, you will find that he is saying there, not that we should simply pray that we might have a peaceable life. We always use it that way, don't we? But that's not the only thought in that context. The first thought is that the one who is in authority might be persuaded by the truth. That in the heavenly places there might be seen the power of the gospel, and that's happened. That has happened in the life of the Apostle Paul from time to time. Great men in high office have trembled before the knowledge of the truth, and God will have all men to be saved, says Paul in that context. And here, I believe, is a classic case. This personally involved Nebuchadnezzar. It was not just that there happened to be a Jewish exile in his realm. He was personally involved with that message. He knew Daniel like you and I know somebody. He spoke with him. He came to realize what an incredible person he was. In fact, verse 48, he made Daniel a great man and gave him many great gifts and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon, chief of the governors, and notice the end of verse 48, and over all the wise men of Babylon. Did you notice that before? Do you know who became over that very school of astrologers and magicians and soothsayers and wise men and Chaldeans? Daniel, the Jewish boy, was placed over the very institutions of Babylonian wisdom. What an incredible statement that is. So surely, my dear brothers and sisters, Daniel would have influenced them. Perhaps that's why later wise men from the east noticed the star of Messiah that led them to Bethlehem. Without any question, Daniel would have left his mark upon that body of Britain, a body of people. I want you to turn to a passage, a very important passage. Keep our hand in Daniel. But a very important passage in Isaiah. In respect to the chapter we're looking at, this is a very important chapter. But of course, being given by Isaiah, it's some 100 years before the events of Daniel chapter 4. But in Isaiah chapter 47, there's a chapter which very clearly shows what was happening in Babylon, not only in Nebuchadnezzar's time, but in the time that led up to it. There was a real trust in Babylon, and it was the greatness of its men of wisdom. And there's a repeated emphasis in this chapter. This chapter, you'll notice from verse 1, is upon the downfall that is here prophesied in this chapter of the great power of the Chaldeans, or the Babylonians. These two things, verse 9, shall come to thee in a moment. The loss of children and widowhood. They shall come upon thee in their perfection. Why? For the multitude of thy sorceries, and for the great abundance of thine enchantments. World famous, the great dependency of the Babylonians. Verse 10. For thou hast trusted in thy wickedness. Thou hast said, none seeth me. Thy wisdom and thy knowledge, it hath perverted thee. Thou hast said in the strength of their wisdom and knowledge, I am and none else beside me. They had arrogated to themselves divine powers and divine knowledge. Verse 12. Stand now with thine enchantments and with the multitude of thy sorceries, wherein thou hast laboured from thy youth. If so be, thou shalt be able to profit. If so be, thou mayest prevail. And finally again, in verse 13, thou art wearied in the multitude of thy counsels. Let now the astrologers, the stargazers, the monthly prognosticators stand up and save thee from these things that shall come upon thee. So in verse 9, 10, 12 and 13, there is emphasis upon that which was the stay of Babylon, the great so-called wisdom of its wise men. Daniel now has been placed over all of them. That is a most astonishing reflection. But what's chapter 3 about then? Well, chapter 3 is Nebuchadnezzar's answer upon reflection and upon the resumption of his pride, his answer to chapter 2. Because chapter 2 said he was the head of gold, but that the kingdom of men would go into other phases. So in chapter 3 we have a remarkable image, a huge image. It was 80 cubits, chapter 3 verse 1. The breadth thereof 6 cubits, which is roughly speaking the dimensions of a man. But this image, of course, is not of gold and silver and brass and iron. It is totally of iron. It is the head of gold saying, there shall be no other nation. There shall be no other empire. We will go on forever. From head to toe, there will be no other image. The head of gold will predominate for all time. So it is Daniel's, it is Nebuchadnezzar's answer and challenge. As he thought it over, like Pharaoh, pride began to regurgitate in this man again, until now he's prepared to challenge for that which God has miraculously revealed to him in that wonderful dream some years before. What is the outcome of chapter 3? Look at verse 28. Remember how that while Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego were placed in that fire, there was one man like the Son of Man who was found in that furnace, and in fact they came out without a singe of their hair. And verse 28, then Nebuchadnezzar spake. You know, Nebuchadnezzar could be touched. Whatever you might think about Nebuchadnezzar, he had a heart. He was an interesting character, a fascinating man. He could be touched, and when touched he could make statements that are absolutely remarkable. Nebuchadnezzar spake and said, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants that trusted in him, and have changed the king's word. Wow, look at that. And hath changed the king's word, and yielded their bodies, that they might not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Therefore I make a decree that every people, nation, and language which speak anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made a dunghill, because there is no other God that can deliver after this sort. So he promoted the three things. Now, my dear brothers and sisters and young people, that really is an astonishing statement, isn't it? There is no other God. And it seemed as though it was like a lesson finally learned after chapter 2. But, being a great king, he has the same problems as Pharaoh. And another event that comes later in his life. We don't know when chapter 4 is set in his life, but I would suggest that it's towards the sort of two-thirds stage of his life. It seems that he was upon the throne for something like 45 years. 43 to 45 years. Which is more than half of that 70 years that I mentioned to you before. A very important point in understanding the times of the kingdom of Babylon is to remember this. That the time of their captivity, which is described as 25 years in Jeremiah 29, is described, sorry, as 70 years, in Jeremiah chapter 29, is the same 70 years of the ascendancy of Babylon. There's a lovely balance in that. Babylon goes up, Judah goes down. So remember that in your understanding of the time period. Just remember that the time, the 70 years of captivity, is the same as the ascendancy of Babylon. 606 to 536. Alright, so if he reigned for 45 years, 43 to 45 years, then he presided over the greater period of Babylon's ultimate achievements. Well, sometime in that period of time, and I would suggest something like perhaps the 25 to 30 year old, the 30 year mark of that reign, sometime in there, chapter 4 was given. Do you know who wrote chapter 4? there's one chapter in Daniel that's not written by Daniel. It's chapter 4. Who wrote chapter 4? It's a chapter of Nebuchadnezzar. You have a chapter in your Bible that's written by Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar the king unto all people, nations and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied on him. The whole thing's in the first person. Verse 4, I Nebuchadnezzar. Verse 5, I saw a dream. Verse 8, but at the last Daniel came in before me. It's not Daniel who wrote this book, who wrote this chapter, so it's Nebuchadnezzar. Verse 13, I saw it in the visions of my head. Then verse 19, Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was astonished for 1 hour. It's talking about Daniel, isn't it? So it goes right through the chapter. Verse 34, in the concluding verses, 34 to 37, at the end of the days I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up mine eyes unto heaven. And finally in verse 37, now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honour the King of Heaven. This is a very interesting chapter. It's a chapter from a heathen king that has found its way very, very appropriately. Who could write it better than Nebuchadnezzar? No one. So it has found its way into the book of Daniel. The theme of this chapter is found from noting the repetition of a theme. See verse 3 of chapter 4. How great are his signs and how mighty are his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion is from generation to generation. That theme is expressed very, very beautifully in verse 17 that we referred to last night. Chapter 4 and verse 17, which is, as good as Daniel 2 verse 44, the best summary of the book of Daniel. This matter is by the decree of the watchers and the demand by the word of the Holy Ones, to the intent that the living may know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men and giveth it to whomsoever he will. There are many other statements of the same thing. You will notice it in verse 25, the last half. You will know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men. And again in verse 26, the last half of that, after that thou shalt have known that the heavens do rule. So again in verse 32, until that thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, it's the repetitive phrase. And again in verse 34, whose dominion is an everlasting dominion and his kingdom from generation to generation. And of course, all of those last verses are upon the same thing. And that's important. That is the theme of this chapter. Though he be king over all the kingdoms of the world at that time, yet he's going to learn that most important fact, that the Most High God ruleth in the kingdom of men. The astonishing thing is that having learnt that, he then sends that to all of his people. As we read there in chapter 4 and verse 1, the statement is said to all people. What an incredible thing that is. And also the last words we find, he states it there again. So it's a conviction of Nebuchadnezzar. He's been greatly humbled. He's learned some magnificent lessons. And again I say, an interesting person. He's prepared to write that down and to send it to all his subject peoples. Now you know, it is a great man that can do that. You think of a prime minister or a head of state today that you can think of who'd be prepared to do that. There isn't one who would be prepared, that I know, to acknowledge such a thing before their people. But Nebuchadnezzar was. And seeing that chapter 4 is the last chapter that we have concerning Nebuchadnezzar, I say that there seems to be some hope that this king, with whom the God of heaven worked in a very special way and gave to him very special dreams, there seems to be some hope that perhaps he may have learned his lesson and have been brought around. Well, only time will tell. Certainly it's unique that he's written a chapter of the Bible. Nebuchadnezzar the king, therefore, unto all peoples, I thought it good to show the signs and wonders, verse 2, that the Most High God hath wrought toward me. This is his introduction in verses 1 to 7. How great are his signs! He's absolutely overcome. He's got a spirit, this man. And how mighty are his wonders! His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. His dominion from generation to generation. And so he tells the story. One day, in all of the prosperity of his reign, he was sitting perusing things. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at rest in mine house and flourishing in my palace. He was a man of great achievements, tremendous industry. It is said that 9 out of 10 bricks that are found in the ruins of Babylon bear his own insignia. In other words, he stamped himself upon the world that then was and built incredible things. How does a man do that in one lifetime? Except he is exceedingly industrious. He was responsible too for great conquests on all sides of the borders of the kingdom. He administered a most remarkable kingdom. Within the confines of that city, he built things that were the wonders of the world. All of this came forth from a most resourceful, vibrant, and living person. So now with those great achievements around him, he was resting in his house and flourishing in his palace. You know, the word flourishing is used consistently of a tree. As it happens, that the margin of my Bible anyway has three references which, among all the others you might look up, are excellent. So you might as well note them down. Psalm 37, verse 35. It's the one that speaks about the flourishing of the bay tree. Psalm 52 and verse 8, which speaks of Doeg the Edomite, who also was flourishing, but then in an evil way. And Psalm 92, verse 10 and 14, which speaks of the righteous as flourishing. How interesting that analogy should be used, because you know what the chapter's about. It's about a great tree, which we find out is in fact Nebuchadnezzar himself. So he's in the pinnacle of his glory. You know, there never was a kingdom like the Chaldeans' glory. The excellency of the Chaldeans' glory. And I say that advisedly, brothers and sisters. There's nothing else in the Bible that ever seeks to compare to the glory, the words of description, the glory which was the pride of the Babylonians. Take, for example, the language of Isaiah, his 13th chapter. Isaiah chapter 13 and verse 19. And Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldees' excellency, shall be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. Where else in the Bible do you have any realm described in such magnificence? The glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldees' excellency. As Nebuchadnezzar also expressed it, I have built, later on speaking about this great Babylon in the chapter we're dealing with in verse 30, is not this great Babylon that I have built the house of the kingdom by the might of my power and the honour of my majesty? It really was a superlative kingdom. And so in resting and basking in all the achievements that represented, he was flourishing in his palace. Indeed, he was a great tree. He tells the story. I saw a dream which made me afraid. Therefore, verse 6, I made a decree to bring in all the wise men of Babylon before me, that they might make known unto me the interpretation of the dream. My dear brothers and sisters, what a clown. In came all those people that had been before proven as a failure. Then came in the magicians, the astrologers, the Chaldeans and the soothsayers, and I told the dream before them, but they did not make known unto me the interpretation thereof. You see, there's that Pharaoh-like quality of pride, isn't it, that does not learn. He's already tried them on two occasions, and they've been found, three occasions, and they've been found to be a total failure. That verse reads just like chapter 2, verse 2. The magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers and the Chaldeans were to show the king the interpretation. And now very foolishly, he has brought them all in again. But what a theme they form through these chapters in Daniel. and particularly those that have to do with the Babylonian period. They are always there. So that chapter in Isaiah 47 very much indeed, in fact, put its finger right on the pulse. They were the stay and confidence of the Babylonians. So despite what Nebuchadnezzar had said concerning the three friends in chapter 2, and the fact that he had put Daniel over all the wise men in chapter 2, yet now he has resorted to this bunch of no-hopers who, of course, were never able to show him his dream. So they having failed, verse 8, at the last Daniel came in before me, whose name was Belteshazzar, according to the name of my God. Keeper of the hid treasures of Bel, that means. Keeper of the hid treasures of Bel. I suppose, you see, they were trying to take the very real abilities that Daniel had and to relate those to the gods of their time. Indeed, Daniel did have knowledge of hid treasures and of secret things, but it wasn't because Bel gave him the answer. It was because the God of heaven had revealed them to him. And in somewhat of a mixture of terms, he says, according to the name of my God, verse 8, and whom is the Spirit, and in whom is the Spirit of the Holy God. And before him I told the dream, saying. So he reiterates the dream. O Belteshazzar, master of the magicians. And of course that's a confirmation of chapter 2 and verse 48, where it says he was placed over the governors of the wise men. So he still has that office. Why then did Nebuchadnezzar resort unto those no-hopers when there was such a man as Daniel to go to? O Belteshazzar, master of the magicians, because I know that the Spirit of the Holy Gods is in thee. What a confession after you've tried everybody else. And no secret troubleth thee. Tell me the visions of my dream that I have seen and the interpretation thereof. So he tells Daniel the dream. Did you notice that? He didn't do that in chapter 2, did he? Remember? He wasn't prepared to tell them the dream in chapter 2, because he knew those chaps. As soon as you told them the dream, they'd make up a story, no doubt, no difficulty at all. A very interesting and sophisticated story to fit the circumstance. So he didn't tell them the dream. If you really have the information from God, tell me what the dream is as well. This time, however, Daniel comes in, has no hesitation. It seems as though Nebuchadnezzar realized himself that not until Daniel would have been very presumptive, because Daniel knew, and he knew that Daniel knew, and he knew that God could give to him the answer of the dream. So he has no hesitation. He knows Daniel's no trickster. He knows that he speaks to him in truth. I saw an older tree in the midst of the earth, verse 10. The height thereof was great. There were 9 features about this tree, which we've listed on this transparency. Well, as you knew, the tree got cut down. Well, they're all here anyway. Verse 10. I saw a tree, and behold, a tree in the midst of the earth. So it was like the tree in the Garden of Eden, isn't it? The tree of life. It was in the midst of the earth, and it was a tree of life. And the tree was worshipped as a symbol of life in the Babylonian period. So that when they made their coffins out and they placed their beloved to rest, they had a tree, a symbol of a tree, upon the head of that coffin. Thus speaking of their hope of eternal life. And the height thereof was great. Have you got a picture of this tree? A really big tree. Have you ever seen a giant tree? Do you know some trees that are over 300 feet high? Can you imagine that? 100 yards. 100 metres. Remember we used to run 100 metres? Well, imagine 100 yards, and now you just lift that straight up. That's a colossal tree, isn't it? And what a wonderful thing to think that the sap can be pushed right up to all those little flame vessels, all those little xylem vessels, right up to the top of the tree. Isn't that an incredible wonder? And still keep it alive with leaves right up the top. trees in Australia, 310 feet high. We saw some trees on the west coast of North America, the great redwoods, the giant sequoias that are 300 feet high. But this tree had qualities that those trees didn't. Not only was its height great, but it was growing. It was still vibrant. What's more, it was strong. There were not dead boughs hanging from this tree, but it was strong. That was great. The height thereof reached unto heaven, and the sight thereof to the end of all the earth. It was a sight of amazement to the world. Its leaves were beautiful, not just a few as of an old tree that's just about ready to turn down. The leaves thereof were fair. What's more, it was a fruit tree, which was unusual. The fruit thereof was abundant. It was meat for all. It was for the tastes of the whole world. The beasts of the field had shadow under it. It was a tree of protection. The fowls of the heaven came and happily dwelt in the boughs thereof. It was the succourer of all the peoples, nations, and tongues. But all flesh was better. Now, there's never been a tree like that on earth. And as Nebuchadnezzar looked at that, he knew exactly that we should think. But I saw in the visions of my head a holy one, an angel, verse 13, crying out and saying, "View down the tree. Such great achievement. So many years of growth. Such a succor and defense to so many. That is fruit to so many. But hew down the tree and cut off his branches. Shake off his leaves and scatter his fruit. Let the beasts get away from under it, the fowls from his branches." And so all of a sudden there's a tremendous scattering of peoples, of animals and birds, fleeing from this tree that though so great is now at the hour of its demise. So this great tree came crashing to the ground. Hew down the tree. Fruit went everywhere, the leaves broke off, the branches were scattered. However, verse 15, a strange thing, leave the stump of his roots in the earth, even with a band of iron and brass. What a peculiar thing. In the tender grass of the field, and let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let his portion be with the beasts in the grass of the earth. Let his heart be changed from man's heart, and let a beast's heart be given unto him. Now, do you see what's happened? It's talking about a person. But it was talking about a tree. The tree has become a person. The his roots, the it, the his fruit of verse 14, is now verse 16, let his heart be changed from man, and let a beast's heart be given unto him, and let seven times pass over him. Now that was a very real indication as to the intention of the dream. The tree, of course, represented the king, and the king with his great kingdom had been in the midst of the earth. Other nations were surrounding him, developing around him. He had reached unto heaven. The pride of the king of Babylon is mentioned, isn't it, in Isaiah chapter 14, as exalting itself unto heaven, the pride of his heart. He was still virulent. He was still strong, flourishing in his palace. He was still strong. He was admired of all the earth. He was abundant in foliage and show. He looked good. He presented his kingdom with brilliance to other nations. Vast supplies of fruit. There was great merchandise that was coming and going from Babylon, and it was fruit for all people, and so he was a succorer of all nations at that time. So he had told Daniel the dream. Verse 18, "This dream I, King Nebuchadnezzar, have seen. Now thou, O Belteshazzar, declare the interpretation." Daniel was very perturbed because he could see through the visions of God what the dream meant. He was astonished for 1 hour. He sat before the king and couldn't get words. He noticed the respect involved in it. He was duly concerned about King Nebuchadnezzar. He couldn't speak. He couldn't tell the king the disaster that the tree meant towards Nebuchadnezzar. Let not the dream, said Nebuchadnezzar, or the interpretation thereof trouble me. Belteshazzar answered, my lord, the dream be to them that hate thee, and the interpretation thereof to thine enemies. What was the personal relationship between Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar? It was clearly one of respect, wasn't it? Which is a lovely thing to note concerning the qualities of Daniel. Why, here was the exiled boy who had seen this king send his legions into his own beloved city, who may have despised King Nebuchadnezzar, except that he knew that by the hand of God these things had been given to the king of Babylon. So he'd come to corroborate with him, to, like Jeremiah had said, pray for the peace of the city in which he dwelt. And so he had a pleasant relationship and respectful relationship with Nebuchadnezzar, even though he knew that he had a hand over Nebuchadnezzar, because God's hand was with him. And so he tells him concerning the tree, verse 20, the tree thou sawest which grew, leaves were fair. Verse 22, it is thou, O king, that art grown and become strong, for thy greatness is grown and reacheth unto heaven, and thy dominion to the end of the earth. And whereas the king saw a watcher and a holy one coming down from heaven and saying, hew the tree down and destroy it, yet leave the stump of the roots thereof in the earth, even with the band of iron and brass, and the tender grass of the field, and let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let his portion be with the beast of the field till seven times pass over him. This, O king, is the interpretation. Now imagine the king upon his throne listening to this. This is the decree of the Most High, which has come upon my Lord the King, that they shall drive thee from men. The they is the watchers who gave the vision, that is, the angels. They shall drive thee from men, and thy dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. Imagine the consternation of the king as he listens to this. They shall make thee to eat grass as oxen, and they shall wet thee with the dew of heaven, and seven times shall pass over thee, till thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will. Now a time was a year, 360 days, as the number of the days of a lunar year were. And he now is being told that they're going to drive him from the company of men, and he will be seen out there in the paddock, and there, like an ox in the field, he will eat grass, until he knows that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will. What an astonishing thing. You know, let us never try with the God of heaven and means of that. Let us never be on the side of human government, because God, in the end, is going to vindicate his name. And it seems that he had looked over Nebuchadnezzar, and while he had had many opportunities, as we recorded before, now the pride of his heart had risen again, and so he's going to break that heart until he really knows that the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men, and gives it to whomsoever he will. You know, God does not look off dispassionately when he sees the pride of nations, or when he sees our own pride. He cannot deal with self-exalting flesh. And whereas, verse 26, they commanded to leave the stump of the tree root, thy kingdom shall be sure unto thee after that thou shalt have known the heavens do rule. And dear Daniel was so greatly affected by the vision that he had seen that he endeavoured desperately to exhort the king to avoid such a calamitous ruin. He did not wish to see the honour of the king so disdained by his courtiers, by the kingdoms at large. Wherefore, O king, let my counsel be acceptable unto thee, my little plea of exhortation, and break off thy sins by righteousness, and thine iniquities by showing mercy to the poor. You know, a king in that position hardly knows the sympathies of the poor, does he? And so it was too with the king of Babylon. Turn again to Isaiah chapter 47. Who were some of that poor who were now in his realm? Well, you know, Nebuchadnezzar now had a very special people among his city, among his provinces, and in considerable numbers. But they were exiles, and as exiles always are, they are poor. They are in desperation. So Isaiah had seen them in chapter 47 and verse 6. I was wroth with my people. This is Israel. I have polluted mine inheritance. This is that same chapter, remember? Isaiah 47. I have polluted mine inheritance and given them into thine hand, O Babylon. Thou didst show them no mercy. Upon the ancient hast thou verily laid thy yoke. And thou hast said, I shall be a lady forever, so that thou didst not lay these things to thine heart, neither didst thou remember the latter end of it. You know, when a people touch God's people, look out! Look what happened to Hitler. He was buried in his nation with him. They drove him into the ground with bombs because of what he did unto that people. And so it was here. The prophet Isaiah is looking well ahead. He's seeing the time when people will be taken from Judah and put among the kingdom of Babylon, because it was God's judgment upon Judah, not because it was of the goodness or the righteousness of Babylon. They were worse than Judah, as Habakkuk had also seen. Look out then at Babylon, when God is lightly displeased with his people, enjoys what they are doing by way of judgment, and in fact brings them into his own kingdom, and then treats them without mercy. Upon the ancient hast thou verily laid thy yoke. And you think God saw that? The old Jews, down by the waters of Babylon, weeping, singing the songs of Zion to the Babylonians that treated them like some sort of foreign hit tune? No way was God going to abide with that. Nebuchadnezzar had presided over that. And whilst God had given him even to seeing into the very temple of Jerusalem and breaking its walls down, and the walls of the temple and the walls of the city, don't let Nebuchadnezzar think that he could exalt himself over the heritage of God. That's what he had done. And that people had been neglected. In chapter 5, verses 18 and 19, and there again the arrogance of a great king is noted. O thou king, the most high God, give Nebuchadnezzar, thy father, a kingdom and majesty and glory and honour. And for the majesty that he gave him, all people, nations and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he slew. And whom he would, he kept alive. And whom he would, he set up. And whom he would, he put down. You know, men were just like puppets for him. He could just do with them as he willed. How does a man build such colossal things in one lifetime? You know how he does it? He takes hundreds of thousands of men and he just employs them in great groups of slaves, pays them virtually a pittance. They have terrible conditions. All that he's concerned about is to erect that monument to the name of his glory. And that's what kings have done throughout the centuries of time. Never mind the disease, never mind the privations, never mind the family losses, never mind the debts. Push ahead with the work. That's how all those great builders of old time have affected so much in one lifetime. And so it was with Nebuchadnezzar. He just used all the inhabitants to his women fancy. So God had given them into his hand. And now dear Daniel, a glorious character, saying, break off thy sins by righteousness and thine iniquities by showing mercy to the poor. It may be, isn't that beautiful? It may be a lengthening of thy tranquility. You know, you can't help but love Daniel, can you? There's a quality there that is very special. A quality that even with a great man, an arrogant man, that he realizes that he may yet be touched. And he had a feeling for Daniel that still wanted to see good brought to this king with whom he had had such an interaction in the past, and of course even now in the present. And it seems that Nebuchadnezzar needed the message of Daniel for a period of time, and for 12 months there was a lengthening of the strength of it. All this that came upon King Nebuchadnezzar at the end of 12 months. So he was given a period of opportunity. But however, he resorted to his old ways, much like Pharaoh of old. He walked in the palace of the kingdom of Babylon. Now it was a spectacular place. The hanging gardens were there, one of the seven wonders of the world. There was this magnificent cigarette that wound and wound up, and on the top of that, as I mentioned last night, was these temples, the first and the second, to Bel Merodach. His palace was an absolute exception, and it was around his palace that the hanging gardens were found. You might think, hanging gardens, so what? But how do you have hanging gardens before you've got plants? How do you have story upon story of beautiful hanging gardens coming down from very great heights? It was a major achievement that the king had worked out. And so, and those walls, the Ishtar Gate and so on, it was an incredibly beautiful place. Like any man walked the palace of the kingdom of God, speaking to himself, is not this great about me? That I, notice the first person, built for the house of the kingdom by the might of my power, to the honour of my majesty, while the word was in the king's mouth. The angel watcher above spoke to me, O King Nebuchadnezzar, to thee it is spoken, the kingdom is departed from thee. That same hour, verse 33, the thing was fulfilled upon Nebuchadnezzar. He was wet with the dew of heaven, till his hairs were grown like eagle's feathers, and his nails like bird's claws. So the ambassadors from other countries came, and they inquired of the king, could I perhaps find a time with King Nebuchadnezzar? King Nebuchadnezzar's not around today. Where is the king? Well, he's not available. But where is the king? He's out there in the back paddock, isn't he? He's out there eating grass like an oxen. The total embarrassment of his ministers. He's not eating the normal things that a man eats. He's eating grass. His constitution has changed. If we eat cellulose, I well remember in my biology lessons, we get no nutrient, correct? There's nothing that we haven't got the, what's that particular organ, that can digest cellulase. We haven't got cellulase that breaks down cellulose. We get nothing out of grass. Even his constitution had changed, so that his hair grew like feathers and his nails like eagle's claws. He was a despicable sight. But he still had some knowledge of what God had done with him. That's the point. And all his courtiers were learning a lesson. The whole kingdom was learning a lesson. You know, in the record of Nebuchadnezzar, there's a period where he says that for a period of years, doesn't reveal all the details, I took no pleasure in my kingdom. Isn't that interesting? I took no pleasure in my kingdom for a period of years. So is the record of Nebuchadnezzar. A period, no doubt, that he would have veiled over, as would of course the historians of the time. South Africa's not the first country to put a blanket on news. So this period then passed over the King Nebuchadnezzar until eventually he was brought back into his kingdom. At the end of the days, verse 34, I Nebuchadnezzar lifted up mine eyes unto heaven, a very broken man. How did he feel, my dear brothers and sisters, when he on all fours walked up into the palace again? And lo and behold, God said, the times had passed over. 7 years had passed over him, and his understanding returned unto him. What an incredible thing. I bless the Most High. I praised and honoured him that liveth forever. He was a totally humiliated, well, more than that, a humbled man, whose dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom from generation to generation. He could see that all that he had that he had built up had been by the might of God, and because God had given strength to his hands. And all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing, and he doeth according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stay his hand or say unto him, what doest thou? My dear brothers and sisters, there must be a greater sense to those things, because in the book of Daniel we have a large scan of prophecy. It goes right through, doesn't it, the kingdom of men. And this tree that was cut down was nevertheless bound by iron and by brass, the intent being that it might in fact break forth again, just as this is a reshooting of the tree. Just as when you cut a tree down, there is hope for a tree, isn't it? As Job says in Job chapter 14, I think it's verse 9, he says there is hope for a tree that if it be cut down, it may shoot forth again. At the scent of water, it will shoot forth again, and another little sprig will come up and regrow that tree again. And so it was told him frequently that he should put a band of iron and brass about it. Not that that was really that difficult to understand. I'm sure that the king of Babylon, who stood for gold, did not enjoy the fact that his tree should be caused to persevere because of brass and iron. But that was the fact. In the kingdoms of Greece and in the kingdoms of Rome, the basic philosophies of the kingdom of Babylon were preserved. Where did the pantheon of gods come from that the Romans worshipped? What then was adapted into Roman Catholicism if it wasn't in fact the heathen practices of the heathen, of the pagan Romans? And so it all came originally back from the Babylonian times. Those bands were placed upon that tree that they might preserve it. And so in that understanding, my dear brothers and sisters, we have to ask ourselves the question, what then is the larger interpretation of these things? Well, there was another little tree promised, wasn't there? There was another little tree promised that would be like a twig, that it would grow out of dry ground, Isaiah chapter 53. God says in another place, in Ezekiel chapter 17, that he would take a little twig of the utmost branches, and he would place that in a well-watered place, and he'd cause it to flourish and be a great tree. That's Ezekiel chapter 17. Ezekiel was a contemporary prophet. This tree was not the only tree that would compete for the souls and salvation of men and for the kingdom of men. God himself would have left a true tree to overtake this tree. However, this tree was going to have a second issuance of life. And as there were 7 years that passed over the king of Babylon, the person, so there would be 7 times that would pass over the kingdom of Babylon, and then it would come back into its own. Is that not a reasonable interpretation? I think it is. If we take 7 times on the principle of a day for a year, anybody wishes to discuss day for a year principle, you'll find 2 references here, in Numbers 14 verse 34 and Ezekiel 4 and verse 6. It's a very well-founded concept in Scripture. So we have a time, which as I said, in the lunar year, and that was their year, was 360 days. Then there were 7 times that were to pass over. 7 times 360 is 2,520. And if we say that that's 2,520 on the principle of a day for a year, then that becomes 2,520 years. So we would annotate this from the time of the fall of Babylon. Like Nebuchadnezzar's 7 years began, of course, when he went out the back door to the paddock. And so also here, Babylon's fall, which was BC 536, becomes the point of the starting of our times. If you add 2,520 to BC 536, it brings us remarkably enough to our own time, the year 1984. And I ask you, my dear brothers and sisters, is there some way in the inscrutable wisdom of God that we can see some truth, a regurgitation of Babylonian influence in the world today. You know, of course, that the book of Revelation describes Rome as Great Babylon. Is there some way in which we could say today that Great Babylon has regurgitated its interests in the world in which we live? Well, there most certainly is. And I'd like to underline at this point, as we will on a couple of our evenings too, that the coming of John Paul II is a coming of extreme importance in world history. He is no ordinary figure. As I have said once before in the company, I think, of many of you, if we wanted to gauge the significance of John Paul II, we may do it this way. He has spoken to more people, larger audiences, on more occasions, in more countries of the world, than any person in history. They love him. They are infatuated with his comely presence, with the graciousness of his words, by the man of peace. And they are flocking to him from all over the world. They never did that to John Paul VI. They rather thought very suspiciously of Pope Pius XII. But to this man, the world is coming. There is a great resurgence in the interests of Great Babylon. And it is not surely a matter of coincidence that Daniel's 2,520 days on this higher interpretation, this extended interpretation, has come right down to our times. There is another little tweak, my dear brothers and sisters, that God in his own discretion has taken off from the utmost branches, and he has placed it as a little tree growing in Judah and springing out of a virgin of Judah, out of dry ground, that's going to come yet and lop that great tree a second time. And he's going to eclipse it when Babylon is fallen. You know, what that means to you and I is something of extreme motivation. Who knows these things? You know, Daniel has been studied for 2,600 years. I said last night that I honestly felt that we had a need to get down and understand that if our Master was among us, if I should say that with some degree of anxiety, that we should understand the book, if our Lord Jesus Christ was here, he would say that 10 times more. I believe that. I really believe that if he said to the Jews of his day, 1900 years ago, he that readeth, let him understand, what would he say to us today? Because we've got all those years to look over it and to understand and see it all fulfilled before our eyes. Daniel 2, we show it to the world 100 times a year. Because we're able to. There's never been a people like that. There's never been a people that have lived in 1984 either. Like you and I. And have seen the events come through unto our days. Now we see this incredible person going around the world, even to Australia this year, later on in October. Not a country, as it were, is going to be left out. He went to the Solomon Islands. Ever heard of them? Went to New Guinea. Ever heard of New Guinea? There's hardly a place he's going to miss out of. He goes around the world, whipping up the stakes of the Babylonian tree again. And so the world has gone after him, as in days of old. My dear brothers and sisters and young people, let us beware, and let us use the opportunities that we have to proclaim the word. Share our personal lives before it is too late.